Let's start with Philip Shaw today, a senior advisor at Goldstone Financial Group. Philip, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John.
It's not news today, but just give me your read on the Fed last week and maybe one interest rate cut this year. Good news, and is that the way it's going to shake out?
Yeah, so the Fed's still showing quite a lot of hesitancy around the inflation issues going on this year. So obviously, for the seventh time in a row, we did not see a rate cut of any sort, and they've maintained this, you know, 5.25% to 5.5% range. You and I have talked about it before, and I still wouldn't be overly surprised to see two rate cuts this year, but I'm trying not to be overly optimistic about it either, considering that, well, at the start of the year, we were expecting three and to have one by now.
Yeah, some people thought it would be more than that. So you're optimistic for two, but maybe realistic for one. What would be the advantage of two versus one rate cuts?
Well, two rate cuts is going to open up a lot of opportunities for people. You know, I hear about it all the time is, you know, companies are hesitant to, you know, finance new operations given the higher, you know, borrowing costs. But even for day-to-day people, that would bring down things like interest rates on your credit card, car notes. It would also bring down the cost to borrow for housing, which, you know, you and I will talk about, but it's a big issue.
You wouldn't do it, though, if it was going to stoke inflation, though, right?
I would not. So I agree. You know, the Fed is really concerned that, you know, if they cut too early, we could run into, you know, the issues we had 40 years ago, 50 years ago, where we had this rampant inflation that we couldn't control. So I know that's where the Fed's concern is. But on the other end, you know, it is starting to stifle the economy. We are starting to see, you know, unemployment numbers coming back up, and things like housing, the higher interest rates are keeping that part of inflation hot.
It's part of the problem. You can know if you act too soon, but you can't know if you waited too long. That is, it's possible we could suffer two rate cuts, even three, but we'll never know if we don't try. If we do try and it goes badly, then we'll know we screwed up. So you can find out if you have too many rate cuts or you do it too soon, but you can't know if you don't. That sounds kind of crazy what I just said, but I trust you take my point.
No, I absolutely agree with you. It's, we're not going to know anything until they start to reduce interest rates. So if it turns out we do too many, that's a risk we run into. You know, just this last month, we saw the European Central Bank cut by 0.25% as well. Really just starting to see, you know, hey, if we do start reducing rates, what is this going to do to us? I think ultimately what the Fed needs to do is do small change and see what the reaction is. Because to your point, John, is until we do, we have no idea what the impact's going to be.
By the way, Philip, you just mentioned housing a moment ago. To what degree do housing prices impact the inflation rate that we're seeing in this country?
Housing prices have been one of the biggest pieces of the day-to-day inflation that people are feeling out there. And the fact that we've still had these high interest rates has really, you know, stifled the ability for that to come down. You know, we're still seeing, you know, sky high prices in terms of houses, in terms of, you know, what it would cost for people to borrow. And that's really hitting the bottom line when it comes to inflation.
Well, is it relevant to subtract that because most people aren't buying a house? That's a tough situation if you are buyer or seller. But if you're not, what is inflation like then?
I always say inflation is personal to you. So I know people that are, you know, lesser impact by inflation. I know people that are impacted by it to a much higher degree than what you would see in the news. If you're somebody who's trying to buy a home right now, you're buying at high prices, you're buying at high inflation rates. But if you own your home and you've owned your home for 30 years or you already have a mortgage, your inflation rate is considerably lower than everyone else. So I don't know how they would eliminate that. It's definitely important that we keep it in mind, but it impacts everybody differently.
I guess so, but I still think that if you're talking about the overall health of the country economically, most people are buying gas and they're buying groceries. Gas prices are down, right?
Gas prices have come down, which has been, it's been helpful for, you know, day-to-day commutes. It's been helpful for airline prices. You know, the energy prices coming down really helps people day-to-day. And I agree with you, John. It's not everybody's out buying a home, but it is. You know, people are every day going from renting to buying and, you know, starting families and trying to put down roots. And, you know, I think we can't ignore it.
Okay, I guess we can't have two inflation numbers. I guess you could have a million of them. But I'm just pressing for a best barometer of how the country is doing, trying to afford food and gas and clothes and sneakers and computers for the kids. And if you subtract buying and selling a home, I guess, I don't know if you can, but then for most people, would it be true that it's not as bad as I might be led to believe when I hear that inflation is stubborn? It's stubborn because of housing costs. Or is it stubborn for other reasons as well?
It's stubborn for a lot of reasons. Housing is certainly one of them. But even if we excluded housing, the inflation in the last, you know, 2-3 years and even today is still pretty high, where you're seeing, you know, increases at the market, you're seeing increases on, and some of it is the, what do they call it? It's the, you know, they keep the price the same, but they're lowering the quality of what you're purchasing.
Shrinkflation.
Shrinkflation. Yeah. They're lowering the quality, or they're lowering the quantity. And we're seeing that all the time. Absolutely all.
Why are housing costs so stubbornly high? I mean, interest rates, one thing. Elise Glink suggested the other day that it has as much to do with inventory, which may have something to do with the inflation rates as well. But it's she suggested just a function as much as anything of the fact that there aren't homes out there. If there was more inventory, people would buy them at 7%. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. I think housing inventory has been an issue in our country for the last, you know, almost 20 years, where we haven't had a lot of new houses being built and nowhere near what we need to. So, you know, a lot of the home builders were, you know, burned during the 2008 crisis, and a lot of them never came back. So we still have not seen new housing builds anywhere near the rates that you'd want to see them at. So that is absolutely a factor. But on the other end, something that kept prices down was, you know, if it was affordable to buy a new house with a mortgage, you had a lot more people buying, a lot more people selling. There's a lot more just inventory available. But if you're somebody who has a 2.5% mortgage, the concept of moving to a 7% is, you know, you're getting half the house for the same price.
I wonder what they thought about that. I mean, could anything have been done? Not, I have a mortgage that's at a very low rate, too. I'm happy for it. Was that a bad thing that I got that mortgage at such a low rate?
No, I think it was great.
It was good for me.
It was good for you. Was it good for the economy in general? That's a good question. I think in general, you would find, you know, people agree that the Fed waited too long to raise interest rates. So maybe we had, you know, rates at that level for too long, and maybe we have too many people that financed into that. We'll never know for sure.
What advice do you have for people, either relative to their investments or relative to their costs of living these days?
My advice is always, remember, these things are specific to you and they're personal to your situation. And so that's where you should really, you know, have your mindset is, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, people are trying to educate the kids, which we just heard about. We have people trying to buy homes. We have people trying to retire. And I would always set your budget. I would always set your investment strategy specific to what is that goal. You know, if you're 25, the retirement goal is quite a bit further out, but you might be looking to buy a house. And are you, even though we've had the stubborn inflation,
yeah,
bear in mind, being able to save, being able to put these things first is a big deal.
Are you bullish on the markets this year? Or I don't know. We've got this speed bump coming up in November. But what's your overall view about markets this year?
In general, I'm bullish this year and have been since really the beginning of the year. And part of that is an expectation that the Fed will reduce interest rates. But a big part of, you know, my bullishness in the overall market is the ability for us to innovate, to design new, to build new, to, you know, do things better tomorrow than we're doing them today. And we're seeing an awful lot of that in artificial intelligence and AI. And, you know, we'll see what that ends up becoming. But my opinion is it'll probably be the catalyst for our next bull market cycle. That said, as I was saying before, I would not get overly optimistic about it, and I would not, you know, adjust your financial goals because I think it's going to be a good year in the market.
Philip Shaw is a senior advisor over at Goldstone Financial Group, goldstonefinancialgroup.com. Hey, Philip, it's always nice to talk to you. Really interesting. Thanks for helping us out today.
Thank you, John.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. That's me, John Williams, with producer Pete at 12:35. And as we often do on Mondays, here's Jim Dahlke, now the Director of Communications at Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative. Jim, that's a new introduction for you. What is that?
Hey, John. Yeah, new work home for me. I'm now at Tech Nexus, which is a great local Chicago venture capital firm that invests in startups, so also collaborates with some larger leading corporations to help them innovate and find the next new technology innovations in their field. So, yeah, excited to be in the VC universe.
Right. So you're on the investor side, not just the reporter side now, huh?
That's right. But still very plugged into, certainly Chicago startups. So I'll definitely have my pulse on what's going on in Chicago as well as some national tech trends.
And where does I'm just going to ask you a couple questions about that, and then I want to go on to some of those stories. But tell me a little bit more about TechNexus. Who are these people? Is this local, et cetera?
Yeah, so TechNexus has been in Chicago for a long time, really one of kind of the OG Chicago tech community players, and really kind of launched as this space to kind of come and collaborate and connect with the local community, and really has grown and evolved from then to kind of really be this vehicle for investing in startups, but really first connecting with these large, you know, kind of Fortune 1000 companies. So they work with these large corporations and then help them invest into technologies of the future. So kind of helping, longer businesses kind of plug into what's new and what's next and help them stay relevant and stay in business.
Yeah, I guess relevancy is the key. I mean, I would imagine the businesses making money invest back in themselves. Big businesses also invest in other businesses too, huh?
That's exactly right. And I think that one thing that TechNexus is able to do is to really kind of plug these, kind of legacy businesses into what's happening on the ground at the startup level. And so, it's allowing them to invest in startups, but also partner with them on different commercial projects and just kind of really learn about like what's happening. One great example is kind of how they help, legacy, boat makers connect with electric boat manufacturers. So really kind of bringing electrification to this, longstanding industry. So it's really exciting stuff.
I guess this doesn't surprise you. Chicago has been ranked as a top six market for startups.
Yeah, this is a new report from a research firm called Startup Blink. They do this report every year, and they found that Chicago came in number six in the U.S., number 15 globally. They looked at 1,000 cities across 100 companies. So here in the U.S., Chicago behind just San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, Boston, and Seattle, which is some pretty high marks. Chicago tends to sometimes find itself on lists like these below cities like Austin, Atlanta, even like Miami, for example. So, certainly a good showing here for the city of Chicago. This report took a look at several different factors, including the amount of investment coming in, the amount of jobs that the startup community makes, the impact that the startups are having. And so certainly a good news for Chicago to show up number six on this list. You know, folks have often said that Chicago being the third largest city in the U.S. should kind of, proportionately rank in that range when it comes to startup activity. And so number six is close, but we're still, behind some players like Boston and Seattle. So, maybe some room to grow, but hey, six isn't so bad.
Does it matter where the money comes from? That is, if I have a business in Chicago, I don't really care if the investor is from New York or San Francisco, right? I guess my point is I'm wondering how critical it is if you're going to be on this list of where the investors are. Is it more important to have the investors in Chicago? Or I presume it's more important simply to have the companies, the employees in Chicago, right?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. Certainly, you want to have the companies and employees and that growth here. And look, hey, money is money. So whether you're raising from a fund in Chicago or elsewhere, you're certainly happy to get that check in the bank. But I do think that there's something extra special about, you know, raising locally, because, you know, it's all about that quote-unquote startup ecosystem that folks in the innovation space like to talk about, right? So it's like, you know, it's being able to invest locally in businesses from local venture funds. And then that kind of keeps the money in Chicago and continues to just, like, keep funding more startups, more entrepreneurs, more investment locally. And so certainly startups are raising money from all over the place, but anytime you can do it right in your backyard is always a win for both the investor and the startup.
The new Bears quarterback, Caleb Williams, is now an investor, huh?
Yeah, that's right. So announced just last week, he is behind a new investment firm called 888 Midas. This is going to be an investment firm that invests in private equity, real estate, and venture capital. So you can imagine the quarterback is going to be backing some startups here with this new fund. Interesting, it was very quick in the press release to announce this is not going to be a distraction from his football activities. It's actually in there. He said, to eliminate the potential for distractions, it was important for me to immediately set up a business operation with established, trusted partners. So he lists quite a few folks who are going to be basically running this day to day, including Lou Wolf, who is the co-owner and managing partner of the Oakland Athletics. So there's definitely some seasoned business folks who are going to be on here. But, it's not the first time, obviously, a sports figure has led a firm like this. Lots of people in sports are creating these kind of investment vehicles. Serena Williams is a big investor in startups. Steve Young has been doing a lot of venture investing. Kevin Durant, Chris Paul. If you are a big name athlete, odds are you probably are investing in startups in one way or another. And looks like Caleb Williams is the latest to do that.
Magic Johnson was a creative, I thought, force for business in California, if you go back far enough. But, you know, we could also think of a lot of instances where people, athletes, made a lot of money and lost it, either through bad investments or who knows what goes on. But it's kind of funny that he hasn't played a down in the NFL, and he already has the capital to imagine this sort of thing, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, those rookie contracts today are a lot different than they were 10, 15, 20 years ago, right? And so, you know, it's funny. The long-standing tradition for athletes was often to open up a car dealership or a restaurant or a bar. And you're seeing some of that still, right? But, I mean, more often than not, you're seeing these athletes spin up these venture firms as kind of the new, you know, as a 2.0 in terms of athlete entrepreneurship.
What was the category, though? Was it crypto that got some of them in trouble? Tom Brady and a bunch of them were promoting some sort of investment strategy or currency and found themselves in hot water for that. Does that make any sense to you, what I'm recollecting?
Yeah, you're talking about FTX, which certainly put an egg on a lot of faces for a lot of famous folks who backed that, including Tom Brady and Larry David very famously was in that Super Bowl commercial.
Right.
And, you know, lots of people are kind of having to sort of walk that back.
Talk about the IPO for Chicago AI.
Yeah, so this is a startup in Chicago called Tempest AI. They went public last week. This is a major milestone for Tempest. Tempest is a homegrown Chicago startup led actually by Eric Lakofsky, who's the founder of Groupon. So after, you know, leading Groupon to its IPO, you know, one of his next endeavors was to launch Tempest. And Tempest is this a healthcare artificial intelligence platform that is helping kind of better tailor cancer treatments to cancer patients, basically using AI to help use their genomic makeup and find these treatments that are super tailored to them and kind of create these plans that are going to be super effective for them. And this is a really nice IPO. So this is a company that within the IPO raised about $410 million, valued them at $6 billion. Stock went up a little bit at the end of last week. It was down a little bit today. They did about $530 million in revenue last year. This is not a profitable business, though. They lost more than $214 million. So still not profitable, but this looks like a company that's planning to do so and is really riding the AI wave here, especially in healthcare. So really interesting homegrown Chicago startup now on the public markets.
Sounds like a really good idea, although I should also say I'm not exactly sure what you just said. But if we can turn artificial intelligence and have it fight cancer, you know, use all of the brain power that the computer can be and tailor cancer treatment for me, let's keep spending money that way, right?
That's right. It's really just smarter decision making in healthcare. So looking at what has worked for people with similar health makeups, you know, somebody with a similar, you know, genomic makeup, work for them. This is what we're going to use for you.
Wow. Wow. Okay, Jim. Well, congratulations on the new gig. Always informative. That's Jim Dahlke, who joins us regularly on WGN, now the Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. TechNexus.com is the website. We'll talk again, Jim. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch now with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new report says the typical black household in the Chicago area has zero net worth. The study was conducted by the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School in New York. It says black households are less likely to own homes, stocks, and individual retirement accounts than most other racial and ethnic groups. They also have the least in liquid assets. The report, according to Crane, says black households are living paycheck to paycheck and have limited capacity to plan for a financial future. For comparison, the median wealth of white households in the Chicago area is $210,000. The company that owns Megabus has filed for bankruptcy protection. Coach USA made the filing in Delaware and says it owes creditors between $100 and $500 million. Megabus has commuter lines connecting Chicago to dozens of Midwest cities. The filing says the company has been unable to recover from a decline in ridership that started during the COVID pandemic. Ridership recovered last year to just 45% of pre-pandemic levels. The company is borrowing money to keep operating during bankruptcy. Megabus has been serving Chicago since 2006. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Thank you. And I have a corn farmer on the line.
We've got a story to tell.
And we'll find out what that story is after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, the corn farmer on the line with a story to tell isn't just any corn farmer. He is president of the National Corn Growers Association. Harold Woolley farms in Minnesota, but his target is Washington, D.C. and the EPA, which has mandated that 68% of new passenger vehicles be electric by 2032.
It's not a fair system.
So the corn growers are going to court. The Farm Bureau, dozens of auto dealerships, and the American Petroleum Institute are joining the farmers in suing the EPA over its tailpipe emission standards that begin in 2027.
Some folks are pretty single-minded when they start looking at methods to decarbonize our transportation industry. They think EVs are the only way.
He says EVs are not as green as the EPA is touting.
It does not look at the life cycle analysis of the electricity that's being produced to run that electric vehicle.
And farmer Harold Woolley says ethanol made from corn ought to be included in the mix to clean up emissions.
We're actually looking to move forward and get higher blends in. We think that would be good for the environment. You know, we think that we can decarbonize the transportation system by including ethanol in our gasoline, and the more ethanol we use, the quicker, the more decarbonization that occurs.
Harold Woolley told Todd Gleason at the University of Illinois that he's confident that farmers can continue to work with the EPA and the federal government, as it has done over the last 20 years with ethanol gasoline blends. On the food calendar, today's National Cherry Tart Day, National Apple Strudel Day, National Eat Your Vegetables Day, and National Root Beer Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
On a phone line, Tricia Prabhu is the founder of Rethink Citizens. This is an innovative group that has recently won a $100,000 reward for doing good work with youth and cyberbullying, as I understand it. Tricia, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
Good. So just tell us a little bit about what you're the founder of Rethink Citizens. What does Rethink Citizens do?
Well, Rethink Citizens is a youth-led movement with the mission of tackling cyberbullying and online harassment by equipping all youth with the skills they need to be responsible, critical digital citizens. I came to this work as a Gen Z leader who saw the problem of cyberbullying. I like to call it the silent pandemic of cyberbullying in schools and communities in Chicago and elsewhere, and decided that enough was enough. that we needed to take on this issue and give young people the tools and resources they need to be positive forces for change online instead of suffering at the hands of online hate.
So are you tackling the bullies themselves and asking them not to do it, or are you trying to help the recipients of that avoid it or process it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our work focuses primarily on helping the cyberbully pause and rethink before they post. So our flagship product, which we distribute, the Rethink technology, can intelligently proactively detect offensive content before it's sent, and then give the potential sender a chance to pause and rethink sending it. And our research, which has been acclaimed by Google and MIT, finds that over 90% of the time, youth that get that chance to pause and rethink change their mind, decide not to post the offensive message. So we distribute that technology to students. We also distribute an anti-hate curriculum that gives young people the skills they need to identify digital harm, encourages them to go to an adult if they see it. And we also run workshops and communities to bring young people together to interrogate their experiences online, talk about specific digital issues, learn about emerging technologies like AI, and give them that education they need to take on the 21st century.
How's the technology implemented? Is it an app on the phone, or how does it work?
So the technology we have several products. So there's an app that works as a keyboard. So when you download the app, what you're actually downloading is our custom-built keyboard. That keyboard replaces your mobile device's default keyboard and works across all of the apps on your phone, from email, social media, to detect offensive content and give you a chance to rethink. So that means, of course, we're platform agnostic and we can work across platforms to effectively detect online hate. And then we also have, other products like a Chrome extension, for instance, which can work on PCs, and that enables us to tackle cyberbullying on computers, on one-to-one devices like Chromebooks, again, across all platforms, and stop the cyberbullying before it happens.
I saw a story about the cyberbullying that's been taking place among the Miss Universe contestants or Miss USA contestants, and it was just brutal, and it made me wonder if, given a chance to not send that, would, in fact, the sender decide not to, since the feelings, the comments were so incendiary. But you're telling me that, given the opportunity, many people would, in fact, pause and not bully the person on the other end after all, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to, the types of interactions we have online versus, the types of interactions we have in person. I mean, think about it. When we're in person, we're really, quite contrived, actually, in how we're interacting with each other, right? We're constantly thinking about how we're being perceived by the people around us. But when we're online, especially if you can be anonymous, it is so much easier to say and do things that you would never say or do in person. And it's really easy to forget your humanity. It's easy to forget that there's another person on the other end, the other screen that's receiving, the messages and the things you're saying. It's easy to think that what you're putting out there is disappearing into the void. So, what Rethink does is kind of give young people a chance to recall that humanity, to bring it back to the forefront. And a lot of young people, for them, that's really effective because it's not that they don't know the difference between right and wrong. It's that they just need that moment to make a better decision. They need that friction that we often have in person, but we don't have online. The other thing I'll say is there's a lot of brain science to back this up.
Oh, I believe that. We are out of time. I want people to go to a website and find out more about this. Is that rethinkcitizens.org?
You got it. Yes.
Rethinkcitizens.org. Trisha, this is inspiring, and good luck to you, and congratulations on the grant, too.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.